Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. I'm joined down the line from New York by Parul Segal, an editor at the New York Times Book Review. On our bookshelf today, we have Joshua Cohen's internet epic, Book of Numbers, and then we'll disconnect from the world as the protagonist in Vendela Vida's The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty loses her passport and reinvents herself in Morocco. And then we'll go from lost identity to identity crisis as we explore how people use race to define themselves in Matt Johnson's Loving Day. That's all to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Parul. You've chosen three books this week best enjoyed on holiday. Before we launch into them, though, what do you look for in a good holiday read?
I mean, I think like most people, I'm looking for something immersive. Holidays are usually also when I catch up on reading, when I try to read what everybody's been talking about, what I've been pretending to read. So, you know, I try to catch up on all my big sort of controversial, interesting, topical novels. And sometimes, usually if I get time, some classics.
Well, so your first pick today is Joshua Cohen's Book of Numbers, which delves into a kind of fictional version of the history of the digital age as a failed novelist takes on a job as ghostwriter for the founder of Tetration, which is the world's sort of most powerful tech company. It's been hailed as the best, single best novel yet written about what it means to remain human in the internet era. Do you think it's worthy of that praise?
Well, I mean, it's certainly... This book is a beast, I think I should say first. It's 580-some pages. And as you say, like, it's gotten really alarming amounts of praise. It's been called, you know, the best novel about being human in the digital age, as you mentioned. But it's also been, like, Joshua Cohen has been called a prophet. It's been called the digital age Ulysses. And it's certainly really one of the more ambitious books to come out this decade, and something that really does try to think through what it means to be a creature that lives in the real world and online. How does our memory change? How does love change? How does language change? I mean, it is a very self-consciously difficult book. So if you're somebody who has, you know, an appetite or love for Pynchon or David Foster Wallace, this is for you. But it is, you know, a really noisy, demanding book to read.
I see. I mean, it's interesting you say that because in a way, Cohen, the author, is doing something quite interesting here, formally at least. The middle section of the novel is kind of an extended transcription of an interview between the two main characters. What do you think that adds?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is trying to mimic the texture of most people's reality these days. You know, we have a number of tabs open on our screens, and in life we move in and out of, you know, the online world and the real world pretty seamlessly. And we're just surrounded and immersed in incredible amounts of information. And I think what he's trying to do is surface that. You know, we live unconsciously this way. We don't really understand, some of us, you know, what it does to our, you know, what it's doing to our minds also. What, you know, we may be reading online, but a crucial point that Cohen tries to make is that we're being read as well. Like, it's not a passive one-way process. So he's somebody who is very alarmed in certain ways about, you know, how much time we spend online and what's happening to our minds and what's happening to ourselves. And I think the book does try to, you know, as much as possible, enact that on the page.
Right. I mean, because there is something sinister about this company, Tetration. I mean, the word that's kind of right at the heart of the novel, but never actually uttered, is Google, it seems to me. I mean, do you think Tetration is essentially a thinly veiled version of Google?
Oh, very much so. But I will say that the CEO who he's sort of ghostwriting the memoir of has a little bit to do, is a bit based on Steve Jobs. But right, he does play with these sorts of kind of Google sort of like goofy, benevolent tyranny, you know, and how... What's sinister sometimes doesn't come packaged as being that way. You know, it's made irresistible, it's made sweet, it's made fun, it's made playful. So he has a lot of fun with that. And he also has a lot of fun with, you know, grotesque Silicon Valley neologisms and the way that living online and some of these corporations are changing language. So, I mean, it is, you know, a dark book in some ways, but it's also very funny. You know, it reminded me a little bit of Portnoy's Complaint in some ways. There's a lot of like, sort of like funny running gags about sex and porn and all kinds of ways that the internet brings out our best and worst and weirdest selves.
I mean, you mentioned there that the internet kind of changes what we think about ourselves. There's something quite revealing here. I mean, there are three Joshua Coens here. We've got the author, the protagonist, the ghostwriter, and the subject of the biography, the founder of this tech company. Is there any significance in the fact that we've got these three Joshua Coens?
I'm sure. You know, he's always somebody that's playing with identity. He's somebody who loves even this trope of having a character who's named after the author. So yeah, this idea of... I think also clear heroes becomes something that you're playing with when you have a number of Joshua Coens populating the narrative, one pursuing the other, writing the other one's story. So this idea of doubling and this idea of authenticity, this is an interesting way that he can play with it, yeah.
Book of Numbers by Joshua Coen is out now, published by Harville Secker in the UK and Penguin Random House in the US. Let's move on now to The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty by Vendela Vida. Like our last novel, this book kind of deals with themes of living in the connected world, except here our protagonist becomes disconnected. She loses her passport and wallet. They're stolen on a trip to Morocco. How does the story unfold from there, Paral?
Well, it's interesting. It's actually based a little bit on a real event. Vendela Vida went to Casablanca and lost her bag or had it stolen, and she went to a police station. And while she was there, she suddenly started to imagine, what if she never got her possessions back? In the book, what happens is the nameless narrator loses her belongings and is presented with another woman's backpack. And instead of saying, no, this isn't my bag, she claims it and sort of claims the woman's identity. So this sets in motion the first sort of mystery of the book, is who is the kind of person that would so willingly surrender her identity and why? And as we're reading it, we start to realize, like, what is this woman running from? What is she running towards? And like a cornered animal, when she feels like she might be caught with this, you know, stolen identity, she becomes another woman, and then a third woman, and then a fourth woman. So it's a really sort of stylish, sort of suspenseful thriller in this way. You know, it's on some ways like a pretty conventional travel narrative, you know, an American woman abroad. It's sort of shot through with these strains of Hitchcock and Patricia Highsmith and somebody trying to run away from herself, and we're not sure why exactly.
That's interesting. You say that this kind of woman, you know, American woman abroad, is a classic trope, and it is. I mean, foreign lands are always good places for people to reinvent themselves in books, it seems, and Morocco is in this case. Well, what do you think the novel says about such attempts at reinvention?
Well, I think it plays on a sort of fantasy that everybody, or some people, at least I have when I travel, which is, what if I were somebody else? What if I stayed? What if I could become somebody else? And in this way that I think... She, as you say, Morocco is an interesting and sort of fertile place to do this, because, you know, she, Vendela Vida, is very much influenced by American writers like Paul Bowles and Jane Bowles, who went to Morocco, went to Africa, and sort of started anew. So, I mean, I think that she's playing on these sorts of fantasies of escape, of living another life, of escaping secrets and crimes and responsibilities, and it's something that I think it feels especially fresh to see a woman writer and woman character do. This is not something we've seen quite so much. I mean, this is, you know, this isn't Hemingway. This is sort of like this young, sort of intensely fragile, vulnerable woman having some pretty interesting adventures.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, there's something quite interesting happening here formally. The book is written in the second person, which isn't particularly common and often quite difficult to do for writers. What do you think Vida is hoping to achieve with writing it in the second person?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not my favorite perspective. And I think that it works and doesn't work in certain ways in the book. But what she's definitely trying to do is to sort of invite you into the self of this woman, you know, and to invite you to... put on this character. And to some degree, this is something that all of us do when we're reading fiction. We get to become somebody else. And in that way, you know, they say, like, you know, a book is like the cheapest trip or vacation you can take. So she's enjoying this. And, you know, depending on how much you like this particular narrative device, you know, it works or doesn't work.
We discover at one point that our heroine has this kind of badly pockmarked face from acne, a face she's been kind of trying to hide for some time. It seems a little bit like the narrator in Midnight's Children in a way, you know, sort of marked by this facial feature. Does that provide enough motivation for you, though, for this kind of constant shape-shifting that our narrator has?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we do read, and again, what gives this book a pulse, like it is an incredibly propulsive book. I remember like picking it up very idly and sort of consuming it in a couple of hours. Like it's a very sort of, what drives it is that you understand that there are some bigger secrets. There is a backstory, and it's sort of given to you very, very slowly. But the point of the like sort of pockmarked face is sort of like rather beautifully and gently handled, because it does become this way of, you know, we're all marked. We're all sort of experts at sort of you know, escaping ourselves in certain ways or desiring to escape. There's, you know, everybody has some version of that pockmarked face. So it does become this sort of way that even though this narrator is called a you and seems sort of, you know, lightly drawn on the page, it also does make us feel tender towards her, protective towards her. We do understand some of her motivations in this way.
That's The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty by Vendela Vida, which is out now in North America, published by Echo, and Atlantic Books will bring it to UK bookshops in September. Powell, your final choice on today's book review is Loving Day by Matt Johnson. It's a story about racial identity. We've got a mixed race protagonist, Warren Duffy, who leaves his life in Cardiff to return to America, where he finds his teenage daughter, Tal, who's been raised to think she's white. This seems oddly timely, given what's been happening in the US in the past month or so, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. And this is something that Matt Johnson has been talking about for some time. Like the main character, he identifies as African American, but could pass very easily for white. He's very light-colored skin. It's timely, and it's also, it's a tricky little book. It's a funny book. It's sort of a book that teases how pious we are, and especially how pious Americans are when they talk about race. And this idea, race is performance, race is play, race is something that can free you and trap you, and race is something that can be negotiated. These are pretty serious things to talk about, and they can seem pretty charged, but, you know, very intelligently, Matt Johnson has put these questions in the mind of a very funny, very sort of irresistible, sad sack of a character who, as you said, you know, has lost everything, has nothing to live for, has returned home to Philadelphia to see if he can burn down his father's house to sell it for insurance money. And to see somebody like him, you know, kind of untangling some of these like really difficult, intractable questions is a real pleasure. It's, you know, to see it being done without any sort of self-seriousness and with a lot of influence from sci-fi, from comic books. And again, I think there's a running theme between all these books. It's how plastic identity is, you know, how fungible, how it can be put on and off, and the sort of pleasures in that.
You mentioned that Matt Johnson's kind of, he takes a lot from comic books. He's known for his work with comics. Does that feed into the book in any way? I mean, how do you see that influence?
Well, I think that, it's certainly like a big influence when it comes to the actual plot. Comic books and a certain, not giving too much away, but there's a certain comic book aficionado who becomes his love interest. But I think in the way that race is written about in this book, almost like an attribute, the way that superheroes have attributes. It's just one thing about them. And it's something that confers particular benefits and particular pains. The way that all, I think, you know, in many comic books, what gives somebody their power is also something that is the source of their greatest vulnerability. That's a sort of like element that he plays in. And also, I think in a bigger way, he's just not scared of plot. He has lots of big, wild, scary, funny things happen. There are lots of like running gags. So you don't have somebody who feels nervous about producing big effects on the page.
It's interesting you mentioned the kind of duality of race there, because it seems that Duffy is battling between being defined by his race, but also, on the other hand, it's kind of his own personal source of identity. What message do you think the book is trying to raise there?
Well, I think that it's tricky because I think this book is very slippery when it comes to sort of like a message, but I think the point that Duffy makes is sort of like he wants to carve out a space where he can be both, and to be meaningfully mixed race in America is something that still feels, you know, a little tricky, a little fraught, you know, even with President Obama, even with so many prominent mixed race people. Like, as an actual point of fact, to sit and think about what it means to be both and what that feels like is something that it feels fresh, it feels a little, you know, difficult to get into. So that's the sort of space I think that the book is trying to create, and that's where it also sort of gets its name. Loving Day is in honor of the interracial couple that, you know, first got married in the United States, the Lovings. And so this idea of sort of a broad national reckoning with the idea of being mixed race, of being both, which the country is. So the country's sort of inability to look and talk about these things becomes part of, you know, Duffy's own struggles with the issue and with himself.
Fantastic. Peril, I'm afraid there we must leave it. Loving Day is out now, published by Spiegel and Grau. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Peril Segal, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review with Karen Krizanovich and Gillian DeBias. But for now, thanks for listening.